From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on February 13th, 2011 in Los Angeles. Reporter Serene Branson was covering the Grammy Awards from the Staples Center, and during a live report, she lost the ability to speak actual words, a bout of aphasia, in front of a live television audience. Was she having a stroke? What was going on? Well, later, Branson assured her audience that she was okay, that she had simply suffered a migraine on live air. And that just puts her among millions of us, more women than men, but still millions who suffer from migraine on a regular basis. Next week, local neurologist and headache specialist Dr. Joseph Mann and the Rochester Clinical Research Team will present new findings on prevention and treatment of migraine. But before they do, Dr. Mann is my guest for the hour. He comes to us from Greater Rochester Neurological Associates, and I warned him I could talk migraine for days, so we will have a lot to talk about. It's great to have you. Thank you for being here. And I also want to thank you for being here on a day in which I'm in the middle of a migraine right now. It's as if my brain, you know, knew you were coming. So it's if I'm slightly off my game. But, you know, listen, if you've never heard of the event that I just referenced, I want to play the audio for you. This is what aphasia can sound like during a migraine. And again, this is Serene Branson in February 2011 on live television. Listen.
CBS 2's Serene Branson is live at the Staples Center with highlights and backstage coverage we're seeing for the very first time. Serene.
Well, a very, very heavy heavy divertation tonight. We had a very Darrison bite. Let's go to Terrace those for the bit. They had the pit.
And they obviously went to the taped piece, and immediately people were concerned that she had had a stroke. She later said migraine. Does that surprise you?
No, that's a very common occurrence in some patients. Basically, however, only 10 to 20% of migraine patients have migraine with aura. Most of my patients, I would say 80, 85% have migraine without aura. Both lead to severe disabling significant disability.
Yeah, so aphasia there, you know, lack of ability to sort of speak. And I've sort of gone through that, never to that extreme, but so I'm not, trust me, audience, I'm not going to make this all about the host's migraine today, but I'm trying to represent at least a portion of our audience. And if you've got questions or comments, this is your hour to try to get as many answers as we can with Dr. Mann. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994, because we're going to talk about treatment and prevention, and what we know works and what we think might work based on what's out there. But I also want to hit this question of aura. You brought this up. Only 10 to 20% of migraine sufferers have aura, which I could describe mine, but can you just describe for the audience who've never had aura what it is?
Yes. An aura is a neurological event that occurs. Most people have a visual aura. That's the most common, and that's you may have experienced this, flashes of light or zigzag lines in your field of vision, or you can't see out of one side of the field of vision. I've had some of my patients tell me that they're driving along and all of a sudden it happens and they have to pull over to the side of the road. Fortunately, the definition of an aura as far as the length of time is 5 minutes to an hour, but most patients have it for 10 or 20 minutes, 20, 30 minutes, and then it's gone, but it's followed by either a very severe migraine headache, a throbbing headache with light and sound sensitivity, nausea, movement makes it worse, or it could be no headache or a very mild headache.
All right, so that's aura. And my mother, for example, used to get migraine aura with the headache, now only gets the aura. Is that common?
Very common. As people grow older, we see more of that you're just describing. I must say that the cause of the aura, we think now, and I tell my patients this, is that there's an electrochemical disturbance in the brain, on the top of the brain and towards the back of the brain, something called cortical spreading depression, where there is an electrical current that slowly crosses from the visual cortex, where you have the visual symptoms, and then some people start getting tingling or numbness on one side of their body, or rarely weakness, which is seen in hemiplegic migraine patients, which is very genetic. But for the most part, also the area of the brain in the frontal cortex, which involves speech. And that's why people have difficulty speaking, like you just heard.
All right. Well, when it comes to that sort of numbness that you describe, and when it comes to the visual disturbance, those parts of migraine connected to aura make some people, people like me who get that, a little nervous. My father had a stroke at the age of 47, and sometimes a migraine can feel, you know, like numbness. And so here I am reading research and reading an NPR story recently. Dr. Richard Lipton, director of the Montefiore Headache Center in New York, published some research that indicates there could be a connection between migraine with aura and eventual stroke. And I want to listen to some of what Richard Lipton said in an online interview about the possible connection of migraine, aura, and stroke.
People with migraine, particularly people who have migraine with aura, are prone to what are called deep white matter lesions, which are bright spots on MRI that appear in the white matter, the part of the brain that connects one brain region to another. We also found that there was an increased risk of stroke-like lesions in people who had migraine.
All right, so he went on to say, on the MRI, they do look like very tiny strokes. And we now know it's a risk factor for these very small silent strokes, but he also didn't want to induce panic that there's not a definite connection, and it's not a large number of people. It's not saying if you get migraine with aura, it's any sort of certainty that you could have a stroke. But he counsels patients now. If you're somebody with migraine with aura, you know, you really need more than even the general population to not be smoking, to be exercising, to be eating well, to be sleeping, all the things that could prevent stroke, because you may be at a slightly heightened risk. What do you make of that, and what do you make of your own understanding of the possible connection?
Yes, and I'm very concerned about people that have frequent auras, especially if they do have cardiovascular risk factors, like you just heard. We think that the white matter abnormalities represent a microvascular, tiny little blood vessel, endothelial, where the lining of the vessel is very sensitive and can cause, can constrict and cause these tiny little areas of abnormality. They're not strokes, but they represent some type of vascular or circulatory dysfunction that we see in some patients with migraine. The cold hands, for instance. That's due to the fact that a lot of my migraine patients have increased sensitivity to the environmental stimulus, which is the cold or icy weather. Some people even can dip their hands in cold water while washing them, and they get blueness or coldness involving the fingers that is out of proportion to what other people experience.
All right, so if a patient comes to see you at Greater Rochester Neurological Associates and says, Am I at a higher risk of stroke now? I get migraine with aura. You would tell them?
Not necessarily. I don't tell them they have a higher risk of stroke. If they're just having an occasional aura, if it runs in the family, and they look pretty neat, they're not obese, they're not smoking. For women, I always counsel them that if they're on oral contraceptives, they should not be on estrogen combinations. And there are plenty of other ways of having birth control without using estrogens.
Okay. So in other words, it doesn't sound like you see a direct link that's any sort of big red flag.
No, because we don't think of migraine now, the etiology or the cause of migraine is just purely circulatory or vascular. It really involves activation of the trigeminal vascular system, the trigeminal nerves, the pathways, and the pain modulating system in the brain.
Okay. Next week, you have an event on Wednesday night. Let me make sure I've got it here. That is, let's see here. It's out at the Doubletree on Jefferson Road, Henrietta. So 6:30 next Wednesday night, and the event is called Migraine Treatments, What Was, What Is, and What Will Be. What will you be telling the public? Can you sort of give us a preview before, yeah, about giving it all away next week?
Yes. Well, what was is very little that we had. Through the ancient times, migraine was seen through their artwork. There are archaeological findings that show like a hole in the skull, which we think people used to do something called trephination, making a hole in the head so that the increased explosive type of headaches that people were experiencing in the ancient days, the vapors would go out. I mean, it's, you see pictures.
That doesn't work, right?
No.
Okay, just to be clear.
You know. So, and really up to the 1930s, there was very little in the way of any type of synthetic medications that were even brought to the fore. Ergots were discovered. They're very vasoconstrictive. So people in the early 1900s began to notice that on a purification of the fungus, the ergot fungus, that you could get some benefit. It was only really in my, I've been very lucky because in my practice time, three major things have occurred. In 1993, Imitrex was born. The Imitrex injection was unbelievable for many of my patients. They were significantly relieved. They couldn't believe it. In 5 to 10 minutes, their headache was gone. And so that began the triptan revolution. And that was what was, basically, and what is right now. We still have it. There are 7 triptans that are out there. Some are injectable, some are nasal sprays, and most are oral tablets. Then, also in 2002, Topamax was FDA approved for migraine prevention, and that was a great boon to so many of my patients. Yet, not everybody responded to it, and not everybody had no side effects. But it was a real major contributory medication for prevention. And then the FDA approved in 2010 Botox for migraine, chronic migraine. Chronic migraine is more than 15 headache days a month, of which 8 of those are migraine, or the headache responds to a migraine-specific medication like a triptan or an ergotamine-type medication, such as some of you may be on dihydroergotamine or Migranol nasal spray. And so Botox was tremendous as far as, and we're still using it for chronic migraine patients. But there are some patients that have high frequency episodic migraine that are afraid of taking the antihypertensive medications that we use. And there are really only 4 FDA approved migraine medications for migraine prevention for episodic migraine. And that's 2 very old beta blockers, timolol, which some of you may remember was called Blocadren, and propranolol, which is Inderal, as the brand name. And then we have 2 anti-seizure medications, the Topamax that I just mentioned, and before that, Depakote was approved as well. But all of these medications have significant side effects for some of my patients. For chronic migraine, we only have 2 things that are FDA approved, one of which is Botox, which is injections of botulinum toxin, A, and that has been very effective. And then some of you may know or heard of the Cefali TENS device, and that was FDA approved for migraine prevention for chronic migraineurs.
Cefali TENS?
Yes.
Cefali just referring to head, and then TENS.
Exactly. Or... It looks like a Star Wars type of device, and it's 20 minutes every day, and it's an electrical stimulation in the distribution of the 2 major trigeminal branches of the first division, which is the supratrochlear and supraorbital nerve.
Okay. When it comes to prevention down the road, is there going to be, everybody wants to know, is there going to be a silver bullet? My first migraine was 20 years ago. You know, 3 years after Imitrex. So my neurologist walked in and said, take the injection, and it helped. It cut a 9-hour migraine into about 3. But I would have guessed even 20 years ago in talking to my neurologist at the time and, you know, the 2 decades later, we would find a way to wipe these things out, that there would be something more effective on the preventive side or more immediately universally effective on the treatment side. And we really haven't. We haven't. So what do we think is coming? What's possible?
Well, I have good news for everybody, and that's why I'm here today and why I'm giving the talk next week. There's great hope for migraineurs in the sense that we have found the Holy Grail. We never realized this until about 20 years ago when Peter Goadsby, who's one of my mentors, a colleague, and supreme in the headache field, noticed that the major peptide that was seen in the drainage in the jugular vein, external jugular vein of patients with migraine was CGRP, calcitonin gene-related peptide. And then he did many experiments, and other people did, but giving CGRP to a susceptible migrainer would cause a severe migraine. And then patients that had very severe migraine headaches, if you took their jugular blood and analyzed it, their CGRP levels were high. And then if you give a triptan, it lowered the CGRP. So CGRP appears to be the key, and we have good reason to believe that it is a major player. And now we're doing research, and the clinical research, Rochester Clinical Research, has two projects going on now for monoclonal antibodies against CGRP, one for the receptor and three of them that are here in the United States and overseas for the actual molecule, CGRP, the ligand. There are four companies. One is Alder Biopharmaceuticals in Washington. One is Eli Lilly in Indianapolis. One is Teva Pharmaceuticals in Israel. And one is Amgen in Great Britain.
And I want to make sure I understand then, though. What's the timeline here? And, you know, what does it mean? So I suffer from migraines. I'm going to do what in the future based on this research?
Well, here we go. This is preventative. It's not for acute management right now. And the timeline is basically we're in the third phase of the and this is the clinical trial. The safety features have been all worked out. It's a very safe medication.
Take it in pill form?
No, it's there's one that is intravenous and all three others are subcutaneous injections. Now, the beauty of it is that these have very long half-lives, and so that you can give an injection, it can last up to a month, we think. Okay, and that's what's being studied now in the clinical trials. And we need patients that are willing to stop their preventatives and are not on Botox to participate. These are, they want patients that have high-frequency episodic migraine, not chronic migraine. And they want people that don't have medication overuse and not overusing their acute managements.
So you need people who have not had Botox, not chronic sufferers, but what's high-frequency episodic? How often?
Up to 14 days a month
of
migraine.
Up to 14 days.
It's an artificial division, but above 15, you're considered, 15 or above, you're considered chronic, and below that, episodic.
But what's too low? Once a month, three times
right.
a month?
Yeah, you want at least two or three migraine headaches a month.
Okay, so up to 14. And if they want to get involved, who do they contact? What do they do?
They go, either the telephone number is on the website, which is www.rcrclinical.com.
All right, rcrclinical.com.
And I think the telephone number is 288-0890.
Do it again.
288-0890.
Now, some are going to say here, Dr. Mann, and I know the phones are starting to ring. We're going to get to your phone calls as well with Dr. Joseph Mann of Greater Rochester Neurological Associates. You just used a very strong term. You used the term Holy Grail. And that is going to feel like an overpromise if you can't deliver on that. You know, so I suspect you wouldn't use that strong a description if you didn't really believe that there's something possibly revolutionary in this. Yeah?
Yes, and everything I've read about this and the reports, people that are doing the actual headache specialists that are doing the actual studies are very enthusiastic. This can be it. This is going to be the first migraine preventative medication only for migraine patients. We're not borrowing from the cardiologists, the blood pressure people. We're not borrowing from the epileptologists. This is ours, and it's very exciting.
Side effects?
Very few. This is a very large molecule. It does not get metabolized in the liver. The reticular endothelial system takes care of it, so we don't have to worry about the usual things that cause medications to be thrown out by researchers. Very mild and no significant side effects have been reported.
And I know you still have more to do, but what's the earliest this could be on the market?
That's what we don't know. And usually when something's in the third clinical trial to get FDA approval, it may take 3 to 5 years.
Okay. So Not tomorrow or next month, but
correct.
But maybe we're on the way there. Let me start to get
it gives people hope that something is on the horizon.
All right, DJ in Rochester is first up. Go ahead, DJ.
Yeah, I just had a question regarding tension headaches, and if they're considered migraines. I have a family member that suffers from them, where all they can do is lay in bed when they have them, and just wondering if there's any treatment for those.
Like yes.
In the neck and almost shoulder area type headache.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up, because the neck is a key player in migraine pathophysiology. If your relative was lying in bed, that's a migraine. And a lot of migraine people have neck pain. In fact, sometimes the neck ache or tension in the back of the neck is the first indicator that they're going to have a bad migraine headache. So you can ask that relative if he has light or sound sensitivity, if movement makes it worse, but lying in bed is the key. There are some, most 90% of the population have headaches, and a good deal have, you know, you've heard the expression, my boss is a pain in the neck. These people are still working, they're not lying in bed. So I would say it sounds like very suspicious for migraine.
That help, DJ?
Yeah, it sure does. And yes, they are very sensitive to sounds and stuff like that. So that sounds right. So what about treatment? Just regular migraine treatment then? Or?
Yes, and that you should actually go to your primary care doctor, and they are very conversant with the triptans, the and also muscle relaxants and preventative aspects. Migraine, we don't we treat lifestyle management as a big part of the treatment of migraine, in addition to medication. So, getting the right amount of sleep, eating regularly, eating the right foods, exercising, all of those, hydration, key things.
Okay, DJ, I hope that helps there. And when it comes to preventive, if you're just joining us, again, Dr. Mann is saying we may be 3 to 5 years away from, his words, not mine, a holy grail preventive, maybe a once a month, maybe a little bit more, but maybe a once a month shot that you can take if you're someone who suffers from migraine, and hopefully wipe them out with very little in the way of side effects. Before that happens, though, there's not a great set of easy answer preventive treatments, but you mentioned magnesium before we began the conversation.
Yes, the magnesium could be a nice non-pharmacological management, 400 milligrams twice a day. Magnesium seems to quiet the brain down so that the migraine brain is hyper-excitable. It's ready to be, it's like a pack of firecrackers ready to be set off. So certain things will set it off. Stress is a big one. Barometric pressure changes. Not getting enough sleep or too much sleep. Hormonal type things.
Magnesium, 200 to 400 milligrams, or you said 400 milligrams twice a day?
Twice a day. And there's also, a lot of times we'll couple that with riboflavin, which is vitamin B2, 200 milligrams twice a day.
Okay. When it comes to other triggers then, everybody wants to know if they've got food triggers. And in our conversations with, for example, Dr. Catherine Levine and others, you know, the answer on food triggers is probably yes, but very hard to pin down because of how many variables there are, which is why Dr. Levine on this program has said stress, hormones, lack of sleep are at the top of the list. But is it possible that some people have food triggers? She said absolutely. It's just, you know, you'd have to be very, very diligent and tracking, et cetera. What do you generally tell people about possible food triggers?
Yes, I stress that actually even more important is eating regularly. Not skipping meals. Hmm. That's a key thing. But everybody is individual, like Dr. Levine said. I usually tell them if there's a suspicion that something like age can cure it or process things caused it, then we stay away from that. Chocolates, aged cheeses are very high up there. MSG. I try to have patients not drink too many caffeinated beverages. You know, one a day, 1 to 2 a day is absolutely the maximum for migraineurs, because although caffeine can help at the time of a headache, if you drink too many caffeinated beverages, the withdrawal of the caffeine can cause the headache. The early morning headache, 48% of my migraine patients have headaches in the morning between 4 and 8 a.m., and that's clearly either something with sleep or withdrawal. Usually it's caffeine in a young person.
Alcohol-related?
Yes, usually that's even more individual, but generally, and a lot of my patients will tell me this, red wine is a definite trigger for a good number of people, dark beer, yeasty products, fresh bread, for instance. So if you're thinking about liquor, if you like beer, I would avoid the dark, heavy beers.
Okay, James in Brighton with a question on treating children with it. Go ahead, James.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I'm a pediatrician locally, and there seems to be a paucity of data in terms of what's best to use for children, you know, who need prophylaxis, who have chronic headaches, who need a daily medication. I'm wondering, doctor, what your opinion is as to what might be best.
Okay, and that's a very good question. I don't treat young children, but the basic thing is most parents don't want their kids to be on a chronic medication. But if they are disabled, missing time from school, that might be an indication to do something. The first thing is lifestyle management. These kids are overstressed. I see that in my grandchildren. School, getting up so early in the morning, not getting enough sleep. You know, anything that you can do in your community as far as changing the those very early morning hours when kids are picked up by the bus. But there may not be anything we can do about that. But if there's car sickness and colicky babies, that might be an indication that a kid is going to go on to have migraine or if there's a family history. If there is a significant GI, gastrointestinal problems, stomach aches, then sometimes periactin, cyproheptadine is used, but it can cause weight gain and it can cause tiredness, but it is a possible preventative. The other thing that most of the pediatric headache specialists, for instance, this fella in Hershey in Cincinnati recommends for most of the patients a low dose of amitriptyline or nortriptyline.
Okay.
And that seems to be really helpful in teenagers.
James, are you seeing more kids presenting with headaches?
Oh, all the time. All the time. I've been quite surprised in my career how oftentimes I see migraines in children.
Do you think that that's related to stress and school pressure, things like that, James?
I would say yes. I remember one very interesting case where I had a 13-year-old, and he was having horrific migraines. And, you know, I was trying one medicine after another. And then finally, I did what I should have done in the first place, and I took a good social history and came to find out that his mother and his father had been separated, and the father was not paying child support. And this 13-year-old couldn't do anything about it but was stressing about it. So I called some friends and a lawyer who intervened, got the father to pay the child support, and boom, the headaches just went away overnight. And I've never forgotten that.
Well, good luck for you, James. Thanks for the phone call. And Dr. Mann, you know, again, I know you said you don't treat kids on migraine, but are you hearing about this more often in kids?
Oh, in teenagers, it's rampant. Migraine is being more diagnosed these days, and so many of my patients have teenagers, and they see it in their own teenagers. They know the kids have migraine, and they try to downplay it because you don't want to get them worried. And we always discuss just what the doctor said, lifestyle management. Many of them have adverse childhood events, abuse issues, or separated parents.
All right, so put me on the couch just for 1 second, because again, the host is going through a migraine right now. I used to have about 2 a year starting at age 17, and they were very severe. I mean, debilitating. And then about 2010, I went from about 2 a year to about 3 or 4 dozen a year, almost weekly. And they've dropped in the last couple of years, but now we're almost at a weekly, you know, once a week kind of a thing. Why, you know, I know you don't know everything, but why, as an adult, why would there be this fluctuation from 2 a year, 3 a year to dozens, almost weekly?
Yeah. What you're describing basically is that migraine is actually a chronic neurological disorder with episodic exacerbations. Unfortunately, we see this. There is a tendency for migraine to become more and more chronic as life goes on. And it's not exactly clear why. I get worried when a migrainer has frequent auras, and I try to use medications to stop that. Because I do believe that the white matter abnormalities that you described in the brain of patients with migraine are significant, and it recommends to me that I have to be more diligent and more aggressive as far as preventing this type of headache disorder.
All right, so if I'm getting about one a week here, get on magnesium, yeah?
I know that you don't like to take medications. A lot of people don't. So I would start with the nutraceuticals, magnesium, vitamin B2, and see what type of lifestyle management we can do as far as prevention, keeping well hydrated. I see you drinking water. That's good. I like my patients, when I see them coming in with a bottle of water, that's great. Getting the right amount of sleep, not too much, not too little, and maybe doing some type of stress management. Yoga is very good, mindfulness meditation, Tai Chi, other things, just working out in the gym. I tell my patients the prescription is 20 or 30 minutes, three times a week of aerobic exercise, even vigorous walking. If you have a dog, you should be out walking the dog three times a week, that type of thing. But if that doesn't work, then I would recommend the preventative medications that we have right now, and probably Topamax would be my suggestion.
What about Botox?
Botox is more for patients that have chronic migraine.
15 days a month.
If you have have it more than 15 days a month. Also, how we consider who should be on a preventative is how much disability. Are you missing time from work? Are you not showing up because of your headaches?
No, it's remarkable because the odd thing about my increase in number of migraine has coincided with a lack of intensity in terms of the pain. Now, the visual aura is the same as ever, but they're not always debilitating on the pain scale. And, you know, in my totally uneducated opinion, I said, well, there's probably because, you know, there's a limit to how much pain migraine can cause in a year. And if they only get two shots at it, it's debilitating. And if they get 40, it's lesser. I have no idea. I mean, that's...
I always think of the idea is that the aura is an electrochemical disturbance in the brain. If it reaches enough intensity, then it's going to activate the trigeminal vascular system, the blood vessels on the surface of the brain, something called meninges. And once that occurs, these blood vessels are richly innervated by the trigeminal nerves. There's a release of chemicals, CGRP, substance P, other neuropeptides, and the blood vessels swell. There's inflammation, and that's what CGRP does. It causes blood vessels to swell, and it causes inflammation, and it causes pain. Now you've mentioned also that you don't have that much disability, but a lot of my patients have constant sensitivity to light, photophobia, they're nauseated, noise bothers them. They don't necessarily have a headache, but they have these symptoms that interferes with their life in certain ways. They can go to work and everything, but they have to have the lights, you know, change the fluorescent lights. They don't feel well. And the nice thing about the new medication is there is CGRP in areas of the brain that we think are responsible for photophobia and for some of these other symptoms. They're called associated symptoms of migraine. And so these are the things also that we're targeting to improve quality of life in migraine patients.
We're talking to Dr. Joseph Mann, and he is presenting next week. He's a neurologist and a headache specialist with Greater Rochester Neurological Associates. And next Wednesday, the 17th, at 6:30, out of the Doubletree on Jefferson Road in Henrietta, he's presenting migraine treatments. What was, what is, what will be. Open to the public?
Yes.
All right. So if you suffer from migraines or someone you love suffers from migraines, that is an open presentation, 6:30 next Wednesday night. And he's got high hopes for a possible preventive treatment, and we've been talking about that. We'll get back to that and more of your questions and phone calls after this short break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on the next Connections, local attorney John Perinello recently said about a client, yes, it's true, he got away with murder. If Perinello knew it, did he have any other responsibility to the system, or was he just doing his job? And is it up to the state or the prosecution or whoever is trying to convict? Parnella will weigh in on that. Then second hour, are we about to see the end of tipping at restaurants? Talk with you Tuesday.
Jhumpa Lahiri won a Pulitzer Prize for her writing in English. So why did she decide to write her latest book in Italian?
I think what is so attractive to me about this path in Italian is that no one expected me to do it.
Jhumpa Lahiri on defying expectations on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You've got about 18 minutes left with Dr. Joseph Mann to get your questions in, and I'm going to get as many as I can online and on the phone. 844-295-TALK, talking about migraines. 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. From Twitter, question from Twitter for Dr. Mann. I've been diagnosed with migraines related to menopause. Will that subside at some point?
That's a very good question. Many of my patients who are just entering menopause, which can last for two to several years, tell me that their mother, after menopause, had no headaches. And unfortunately, I'm not really seeing that. I may be seeing the worst patients or the patients that have more problems with migraine, but it's not a given. Women these days are out in the work field. They have the same stresses that men have, the same situation with what's called the sandwiching between their elderly parents and their teenage kids, so that they don't get enough sleep. So we have these other triggers, not only hormonal. So that's a problem. If 90% of your headaches were related to hormonally, then there may be more than a 50% chance of a very big drop. But most of my female migraine patients don't have just the hormones as their trigger. They have many other triggers.
All right, Roy in Rochester. Next up, go ahead, Roy.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes. I had migraines when I was in college, but I seem to have sloughed a lot of that off. But just a few years ago, I had a series of retinal detachments. And while I was recovering from that, I had, light sensitivity, other things. But I'd have these extended periods of color, like undulating color in one or both eyes. And they had said, migraine. But I guess I always thought, where's the headache?
Well, you
there's
don't
something I'm missing.
You don't have to have headache to have migraine, right, Doctor?
Correct. And you have a special situation, but there is an entity called retinal migraine, which is just what you're describing. The neurological symptoms, the movement in the visual field, if you're seeing undulating things like smoke or movement that you're, I don't know exactly what you're saying, but basically...
I saw gold coils.
Okay. If it's moving, it may indeed be, and it's moving from one visual field to the other, it may be a migraineous aura that's only confined to the retina. And we, occasionally that happens. The actual retinal detachment is not a... not something that's directly related to migraine, as far as I know. But the consequence may be.
Okay. Thank you.
Roy, thank you. Hope that helps. And listeners, if you've not ever had a migraine aura, just Google migraine art, and you will see on the visual image searches throughout history some really interesting artwork from people who are migraine sufferers. And I think you'll see a number of them. There's some pastoral scenes with kind of an aura, a crescent moon of sparkles and zigzags. That is me every time. And if you've never seen it, I would highly encourage you to check it out, because that perspective, that's what we get every time, the aura sufferers of the world. This is Marla in Rochester. Next up. Go ahead, Marla.
Hello. I have a comment and a question. I suffered from migraines without aura for many years, and about 20 years ago, I was put on a very low dose of amitriptyline, and that has basically stopped my migraines.
Okay.
And my question is, I was recently diagnosed, my dizziness was recently diagnosed as migraines that have changed as I've aged. And I'd like to hear some comments about the dizziness piece.
Oh, well, actually, if things have been ruled out in regards to the vestibular system, in the ear canals and the labyrinth of the ear, and you don't have progressive hearing loss, then the migraine-associated vertigo is a definite diagnosis that I've seen in many patients. Now, most of those patients have had a history of car sickness or motion sickness, and there's motion intolerance, so that if you're shopping and you're going down the aisle and scanning, some of my patients tell me that that causes dizziness. It's a mild disequilibrium of being off. It's not a true vertigo where things are spinning around. Is that what you're experiencing?
She dropped the call, Dr. Mann.
Okay, sure.
But hope that helps. And speaking of vertigo, separate question, but comes from Lynn on email. Evan, could you ask Dr. Mann if he has information on treatment for MAV, migraine-associated vertigo? My brother-in-law has been out of work for 3 weeks, flat out on bed with this. His doctor didn't start meds on time, and now he's just doing physical therapy. He's desperate. Any suggestions or local specialists? And she's saying also Syracuse area specialists as well. That's from Lynn asking about MAV.
It's very difficult to... there's no one medication, and it depends on the actual symptoms. What we think is going on is that the area of the brain called the brainstem, which has some control over the vestibular system, is activated. And so anything that quiets that area down, so some people would even use strong anticholinergic type medications. Some people would use tricyclics like nortriptyline. Some people would use, for the short period of time, and although it's not recommended, clonazepam, which is a benzodiazepine that has a long half-life, and that's been very helpful for acute management of some patients with migraine-associated vertigo.
Clonazepam.
Clonopin is the brand name, yes.
Yeah, and often known as an anti-seizure medication, I think.
Yes, it has anti-seizure properties. It is... it's a controlled substance, but we've had success with it.
All right, let me get back to the phones. And Kristen and Henrietta, you're up with Dr. Joseph Mann from Greater Rochester Neurological Associates. Go ahead, Kristen.
Hi, I'm calling. I have a friend who feels like she's been told by other doctors she's had an aura for about 2 years now. She sees spots regularly. She feels nauseous at times, gets dizzy, just generally doesn't feel well all the time. And she's just hoping for some suggestions, I guess, whether it's a migraine or not.
Kristen, just a quick question, and maybe Dr. Mann can help with this as well. You said she sees spots.
Yeah.
Do you mean like floaters?
Like floaters.
Dr. Mann, floaters and aura, not necessarily the same, right?
Correct, yeah. That's the key thing, the description of that. But it does sound like, otherwise, if there's, does she have a family history? This is the things that I would ask, a family history of migraine and more sensitivity to light, noise, odors. Are the usual triggers occurring if she doesn't get enough sleep or too much sleep, whether weather changes or increased stress? If that worsens these symptoms, then she really should maybe even get a referral from her primary care doctor to a neurologist in the community. We have a very good neurological community here, very top notch.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think she has any of those symptoms. But yes, I will definitely relay that information to her.
Thanks, Kristen. I hope that helps there. Let me get Jennifer next up in Avon. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Hi, Dr. Mann. I'm a physician assistant. I work in OBGYN here in the community. And I was wondering if you could discuss the use of oral contraceptives in migraines with aura.
Oh, yes. First of all, you can use them, but I generally, if... there's sort of a controversy about this. If a woman has just one aura a year, or just a couple of auras, then we don't get too worried about the combination of estrogen and progesterone in the pill. If the aura, and also if the aura is just a simple aura, a visual aura lasting 10 or 20 minutes, okay. If someone has more complicated auras with sensory disturbance in addition to the vision or trouble with speech, or then I encourage the patient and the doctor not to use any, only use progesterone, only birth control pills, or IUDs. The Mirena IUD has been fantastic for a lot of my migraine patients.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer. Okay. Hope that helps. Bree writes an email and just wants to know, for those of us for whom migraine is related to barometric pressure, is there any way to ward that off? Is there any extra help that someone like Bree could get?
That's, I wish I knew. If I had the answer to that, I probably could significantly improve my patients' lives.
It's a lot of people.
Yes. This, yeah? Yeah. I think it's very big here in Rochester, and a major cause of an exacerbation of people's underlying headaches. I always tell my patients that we try to do everything else. Eat the right foods, keep well hydrated, exercise, get your sleep. But there's no one medication that I found that is guaranteed to prevent the triggering of the headache. So you have to do everything else that you could possibly do. We have, there are triggers that are modifiable and non-modifiable, and barometric pressure is non-modifiable.
Sure, but if you see there's a change in the weather coming, make sure you are sleeping regularly, eating regularly, maybe going to yoga.
Yes.
And drinking a lot of water. He's raising that bottle of water. Dr. Joseph Mann, my guest from Greater Rochester Neurological Associates, talking migraine. Emily writes, I've heard of something called migraine glasses. What are they and do they work?
Okay. Many of my patients have severe photophobia. The light sensitivity can be a major symptom and cause a good deal of havoc for patients. What we're recommending now is considering tinting the lenses with something called FL41. It blocks a certain wavelength of light that we think causes the photophobia, which is actually pain. The tinting is indoors. We recommend about 35% tint. It's sort of a yellow-orange tint. There's several optometrists in Rochester that know a good deal about this. And also there are computer sites that are selling lenses for this. It's generally, you want to get a pair of lenses that are new, that don't have any scratches. But yes, there's definitely something going on that you can do for photophobia, and that's one of them.
All right, so forgive me, do they look like normal, regular old glasses? Do they look like sunglasses or shades?
They look like light sunglasses.
Okay.
Lightly tinted sunglasses that have a sort of an orangey tint.
And you would wear them for preventive reasons.
Yes.
And are they expensive and are they covered by insurance?
I don't know the cost.
So can't answer that one. But worth exploring with your
optometrist.
Start with an optometrist.
Yes.
So maybe talk to your neurologist, optometrist, if you're interested in that, Emily. I got a few more minutes here. Are there any surgeries out there, migraine surgeries? I've heard of several different kinds. Are there any surgeries that you've seen enough evidence to say, yes, that has great promise as a preventive cure for migraine?
No, and again, a very controversial, not enough to go on to say, to recommend to any patient that they have surgery for migraine headaches.
Do your patients ask about surgeries?
Yes, they do. And some of them have had cosmetic surgery involving the frontalis muscle, in the brow, and their headaches went away for a while and then they came back. So I don't recommend it right now. It's not the way to go.
Okay. Should chronic migraine sufferers get a brain scan to determine if there's been any lasting damage?
No. Only if there is something unusual going on, if there's a change in the headache pattern, if all of a sudden they're getting a different trigger for their headaches that doesn't make any sense. People that don't have a family history and no other reason to have migraine, and if they're getting an unusual headache, then we usually get a scan.
Dr. Mann's here because next Wednesday, that's February 17th, 9 days from now, at 6:30, he's going to be out of the Doubletree on Jefferson Road in Henrietta. It's a public presentation called Migraine Treatments, What Was, What Is, What Will Be. And if you're interested, you can head out there at 6:30 for that presentation. Wrapped up in that is the possibility of understanding where we're going in maybe 3 years, maybe 5 years, maybe beyond, because of the research and the work that's been going on. I got about 90 seconds left for anyone who missed it. Dr. Mann used the term Holy Grail, and again, he knows I'm going to try to hold him to this, but he's saying it may be, as a preventive side, a case where you could, about once a month, use a shot, give yourself a shot. I guess you could probably maybe do it at home, right? That's,
yes.
That's what people do with Imitrex. Give yourself a shot for a preventive fashion. And just the short description is, what would this look like? You'd go to your neurologist, they'd prescribe it, you'd hopefully insurance would cover it, and that's it?
Yes. As simple as that.
Okay. And your hope is that this will work. And what's the one-minute explanation? Why are you so hopeful for this one? After all these years, why could this be the Holy Grail?
Because the research now shows that the neuropeptide CGRP, calcitonin gene-related peptide, is a major player, and that's what we want to stop from causing the inflammation and the pain and the vasodilation of migraine.
And you've got a way to target it now in a way that you think might not even have much of a side effect, right?
Yes, it's very safe. There's no liver toxicity because it's not metabolized in the liver. It doesn't cause any organ problems.
All right. If you want to participate in a clinical trial, you know someone who will do that. They need people to do that through Greater Rochester Neurological Associates. I'm sorry, no, it's through the Rochester Clinical Research, which is online where?
Yes, www.rcrclinical.com.
rcrclinical.com. And through there, you can find the phone number, you can contact them. They're looking for people to get involved. And, you know, if all goes well, maybe we will be back here on this program talking about this in 3 to 5 years, Dr. Mann. So if people like me hope that you're right.
Okay, thank you for having me here.
Thank you for taking the time. Dr. Joseph Mann from Greater Rochester Neurological Associates and the Rochester Clinical Research Team. Next Wednesday night at the Doubletree, Migraine Treatments, What Was, What Is, What Will Be. And if you, like me, suffer from migraine, like our friend Val or others, good luck to you. We are all looking for the Holy Grail. Thanks to Valerie Labenka, our engineer today. And the great team behind the glass. A packed house today. Megan Max, the producer. Marielle Brinkerhoff. Great to see Caitlin Madison back in here helping out today. I'm Evan Dawson, and we will talk with you on a Tuesday.